Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Everybody, how you doing this evening? Chris Jordan here, coming at you in live fashion tonight from North Austin. Man, we have a great set of conversations for you tonight. Here in a second, we will be joined by the indomitable Jason McLean of Jason McLean Questions Everything, as well as author of The Complete 2017 and Beyond Tetralogy, as well as Metroplex Monsters, a guide to monsters in the DFW Metroplex area. We will be talking about modern dinosaurs, appearances of such cryptids and other things, not only in history, but in modern times, as well as some of the things that grip our paranormal communities, whether it be cryptid communities, paranormal haunting communities, ghosts, things like that, UFO communities. There are some similarities there and some things that, you know, I don't know. I'm one of those. I am always here for conversation. We are here to grow with each other in this world. And without that conversation and without challenging each other, without challenging evidences, things like that, we aren't growing. The science isn't growing. So we'll be getting into that in our first conversation tonight with Jason McLean. In our second conversation after commercial break, we will be joined by the amazing Lynn Buchanan of PSI. He is also of the previous government Stargate remote viewing program. We will be talking about the history of remote viewing, how he came into the government Stargate program and was one of the military remote viewers gathering intelligence, and what remote viewing is really all about, getting rid of some of, like we like to do on this show, dispelling some of the confusion, dispelling some of the misunderstandings about it. I myself just started my classes from Lynn Buchanan today. I took my first few video classes. I have started my journey of remote viewing. I can't wait. I have talked with Lynn privately on so many occasions, and to be taking classes from him, I am so honored. So thank you so much, Lynn Buchanan, for everything that you do over at crviewer.com. Our guest in the first segment, Jason McLean, he is not only an amazing author and just mind like a steel trap and really an amazing conversationalist when it comes to these things, he's also a bang up artist, y'all. He made my digital avatar via request, and I gotta say, he nailed it. Jason, welcome back to the show. How are you doing, bud?
Hey, Chris, always glad to be hanging with y'all. You know that.
Absolutely, man. I love having you on. Thank you so much for stepping in. We were supposed to have Anne Celine on, and she ended up being crazy, crazy busy with stuff. But we will be having conversation with her. So, yeah, she ditched on me. You know? That's
well,
cool.
I'm a poor substitute for Anne. I can say that.
Well, I'm glad that we're having the conversation that we're having tonight, though, especially the latter part of it, because I think it's one that bears to be had, especially with all of the burgeoning evidence in various areas of the paranormal. You know, yeah. There is so much that is going on, so much that is being released scientifically that really verifies a lot of things in a lot of ways. And I think that it's time that these communities kind of stop the infighting and actively start communicating across the borders, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that's very much what I'm about, is just my argument has always been, yes, I come from a very specific perspective. I've never shied away from that. But what I want is everything on the table, right? Just put everything on the table so we can actually start looking at this with a whole, with broad eyes. Because the problem is, so much of what we talk about is isolated. It's restricted to a very small pool. And a lot of evidence is taken off the table. It's hidden. It's distracted because it doesn't fit within a worldview. It doesn't fit within someone's preconceived notion of what it should be. And so they don't want to talk about it, right? Whether it's the paranormal aspects that are encountered within what are called Bigfoot accounts, right? Or even UFO accounts. Or again, when Bigfoot doesn't behave like a paranormal creature, as you know, those get often shoved out by depending on what side of the crowd you are over there. All I've ever asked is just, let's put everything on the table and move on with our lives so we can figure this stuff out. One thing I've said a long time, and you can use it. I just want $10 every time you do. If you'd gone back in time 600 years and said, hey, the reason you get sick is because there's little animals so small you can't see.
Yeah.
People would look at you like you were nuts, right? Because that idea wasn't on the table. The idea of cells and microbes and bacteria, none of that was on the table. It was outside their purview. What if a lot of what we encounter within the realm of Fortiana is simply not on the table yet, because we don't even have words or language for it? And some of it we probably do. Again, some of these things are probably biological entities running around, flying around, and we can deal with that. Great. Well, let's put that evidence on the table. But then some of the stuff may legitimately be weirder and falls into a very different realm that we have no way to objectively observe yet, in which case we just need to be honest about that and have that conversation.
Yeah.
Because until we do, we're just going to keep flailing around the dark. We're going to keep punching each other and not get anywhere at all.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and that's just it. And it, once again, it doesn't further the conversation. It doesn't further the science of research, and it doesn't help build the community across shores from the encampments, you know, to make sure that we are all going out for the same vested interest and that we are trying to all reveal the same truth, you know, maybe through a different path.
Yes. Well, and again, let's all just share the same notes and work off of it and come to a conclusion. Because what if one of the issues is that we're having a problem of language? One of the things that, again, when I was on Texas Front Porch, one of the things that we kept talking about over and over again is, why do we have this seeming disparity between physical encounters with Bigfoot and then you have these other clearly paranormal things? What's going on here? And the question we just asked is, well, what if this is two different phenomena? And we're just all assuming it goes into the Bigfoot box, but what if it doesn't all belong in that box? You wake up in your room, middle of the night, and there's a giant 7-foot-tall dark figure with red glowing eyes. It's a demon or a shadow person or filling, you know, whatever word you want to use. But you unzip your tent and you see the exact same thing. Suddenly it's a Bigfoot. Right. And it's like, okay, well, hold on. What if the problem is we're putting a lot of things into a Bigfoot box that doesn't belong in the Bigfoot box? And what if that's the problem? What if, now again, what if there is a paranormal entity or paranormal entities that want us to think they're Bigfoot? Maybe we're confusing them for Bigfoot, but we're putting that in the box, marking it Bigfoot, and we're arguing over essentially two different phenomena.
Yeah.
In which case, okay, great. Well, we're never going to get anywhere because you're showing this stuff, we're showing this stuff, and we're arguing over it. And it's really, let's just take everything out of the box and re-examine it. What does the evidence actually lead you to believe? Or and what if again, whatever the worst part is, there's multiple phenomena, multiple physical phenomena, multiple paranormal phenomena, but we're all trying to cram it into this box.
Because it
makes us feel better.
Well, and, you know, that has been one of the things that I've said about the reclassification of UFO to UAP. Yeah. A lot of people have been very upset about that. However, when you break that down and when you get to the point of, you know what most scientists have a stigma with researching? UFOs. When you call something a phenomenon, that now, same thing that the head of the NASA science team said, that now puts it directly in our purview. We are scientists. Our job is to question anomaly. Our job is to figure out why anomalies occur in a lab, you know? So let's find out if any of this is repeatable. Let's start treating this like anomaly. And yes, very much the definition and the semantic of that makes a huge amount of difference as to whether or not physicists start getting involved with the equation. People with letters and commas, you know, things like that after their name. Because for the longest time, you were kicked out of fields. You lost tenures. You lost textbooks that had your work in it. All kinds of things if you were coming out and saying, like, you were looking into UFOs. Or you UFOs, were researching the exotic physics of UFOs, what have you.
Exactly. Well, but the stigma is all of Fortiana.
Absolutely.
And very deliberately so. And that's, someone very famously asked, I just forgot his name. I'm terrible with names. And again, my wife caught a cold. Maybe it's like a minor flu over the holidays. And so now she has lovingly shared it with me.
Love is.
That's what love is. It's sharing your germs. I cannot believe leading physical anthropologist looked into Bigfoot. Grover Krantz. I knew I'd get it. Funny story. So my archaeology professor, the dude was basically my minor because you couldn't major in archaeology at my school. He was literally one of Grover Krantz's students. He was a leading physical anthropologist as well and archaeologist. So I got those stories directly from my professor, who was his student and was friends with Grover Krantz up until the day he passed. So I got all those stories directly. Well, he was famously asked, okay, does your college support your search for Bigfoot? He says, of course they support me. They haven't fired me.
Right?
I mean, that's the truth of the matter. That is the truth. If you looked into Bigfoot, you looked into living dinosaurs. Again, one of the reasons I'm not an archaeologist is because I realized real fast. And again, this wasn't something I just pulled out of thin air. This actually happened. If you're a professor, if you're an archaeologist and you find the wrong thing, you become a florist.
Pretty much.
So I realized, okay, there's no future because of the things I really wanted to look into. I wasn't going to be allowed to look into it. And so, okay, I just sort of understand my life took a different turn and here I am with you. But, you know, to bring it back to the initial point of it, you know, living dinosaurs, like I saw a living pterosaur in 1992 in Dallas, you know, a suburb of Dallas, Texas. I thought I was crazy for years.
Well, let's get into that sighting real quick and exactly what the circumstances were behind that, Jason, because that is that moment of, as we say so frequently on the show, ontologic shock, where everything that you know to be true no longer is.
Yeah.
You know, everything that you've known as a firm footing of reality just kind of crumbles underneath you. How did that circumstance come to be that you witnessed this, and how did that affect you when it did?
So let me go back to summer 1992. I have the story in Metroplex Monsters. You know, it was summer. I was fishing with a friend in Ten Mile Creek. Texans are great at a lot of things. Naming things is not one of them. It's like, why is it called 10 Mile Creek? Because it's a creek that's 10 miles long. Like, that's what it is. That's how we name things around here.
We're pretty simple with that.
Yeah. It's like, why did you call it Cedar Hill? Because it's a giant hill that it was covered in cedar trees. That's how we do things. So the thing about North Texas is that it sits on a giant limestone slab. And so a lot of the bigger creeks and rivers are cut in deep into those, into that limestone, right? And so really you can't see into the creek unless you're in the creek itself. And we can come back to that idea later. I call it the green wall in the book. But I'm there, we're fishing, it's getting about 11 o'clock. My friend is already, you know, we're packing up. He's already gone up the hill to go, you know, to actually leave the creek, because where we were, the wall had collapsed, right? So it sort of created a bank and allows you to get into the creek. I'm leaving. I hear this sound. It's clearly an animal sound, but I've never heard it before, right? And, you know, it's the 80s, so we spend all of our time outside, and we spend a lot of time down there. So I'm very familiar with the sounds of the animals in the area. And so I'm like, huh, well, I'm already inside the tree line. I poke my head out of the tree line, and I see coming across the corner of this creek, I'm sort of like in the middle of the straightaway, I think I see what I'm looking at is the biggest blue heron I've ever seen in my life, 8 to 10 foot wingspan. And I'm like, that's a really big blue heron, because it kind of looked like it the way it was shaped.
Sure.
The color, right? Blue herons have sort of a Payne's gray. It's a bluish gray. And so you have to remember, I'm in the tree line, so I'm elevated up on the bank. This thing is flying in essentially eye level to me. And once it gets to about literally 5 feet from my face, its right wingtip is 5 feet from my face. That's when I suddenly realize it doesn't have feathers. It's covered in skin. You know, sort of the wings are fleshy. It's this gray, fleshy thing. And what I thought had been its legs sticking out from behind it was a long flanged tail. And I'm like, I was like, wait a minute, what is happening here? Like, there wasn't even time for emotion. There was just the realization of what I was looking at. Plus, I was clearly not in danger. And so I watch it fly off. And then it just banks and goes around the curve and disappears. And then that's it. That's all there was. You know, it's probably 10 to 15 seconds, maybe 20. But it like I said, when I said it was shaped like a blue heron, you know, when they fly, a heron will stick its, will sort of do this S curve thing with its neck, right? Where it sort of rests its head on its shoulders and it sticks its legs out behind. That's what I thought I was looking at, because it did the same thing. It sort of rested its head on its shoulders. And what I thought had been its legs was a long tail with a flange, with like a diamond-shaped flange on the end of it. And so I didn't believe what I had seen, because this is the craziest thing. Like, I grew up on tales of Loch Ness Monster, Mokele Mbembe, Bigfoot, right? I mean, I'm a young Earth creationist, flexible in what young means, but I believe that there were dinosaurs around, literally. I'd heard the stories, but I didn't believe that could be there, right? Suburb of Dallas, Texas. There's no way that's real.
Yeah.
There's no way I saw that. That's for something out there. What's worse is later on, like I think it was in like 2 years, the Mysterious Origins of Man came on NBC, and David Hatcher Childress was talking about accounts of living pterosaurs in Texas. And I'm still like, yeah, but that's all way far south. That's the Rio Grande Valley. That might as well be a world away. You know how big Texas is. So yeah. I still did not believe my own encounter. And then it's been a while now that I think about it. Mm-hmm. Okay, here's the worst part. I had known Ken Gerhardt for several years before I ever told him my account. And the stories of how it got to that point is a much longer story we can talk about later. But like, I'd known Ken for years, and finally I tell him this, you know, what happened, and it's like, where's this story been? But it was connected to the fact that they were doing a documentary, him and Lyle, on, in fact, you can find it on YouTube, American Monster Tour. It's the Oklahoma Demon Flyer. That's when I come to find out that there were other people in southern Oklahoma that had these encounters, that had seen them. And I'm like, and I remember the first time he showed me this statuette that one of the eyewitnesses had made, and it was doing the neck thing, right, where there was sort of an S-curved neck. Yeah. And I'm like, holy cow, other people have seen this. So I start going around and asking people. And it shocked me how many people, I didn't have to look hard to find people who had seen this thing or seen them. And probably even the worst part of the whole thing is a few years earlier, I had written a very small pamphlet called Wyvern, proving ramphractoid pterosaurs, they're not technically dinosaurs, they're flying reptiles, but that proving that they, using art history to show that these things had to have existed into modern times. And I didn't believe my, and I still didn't believe my own account at that point.
Yeah.
I was going back and showing how we have visual evidence of, you know, from art history where people were creating things that didn't make sense unless they had seen a living ramphractoid pterosaur.
Yeah.
And I wrote that booklet and I still didn't believe my own encounter. That's how terrible my story is. But it's like, yeah, I have in mind like a rusted steel trap, dude.
I have zero issues with somebody literally doubting their own encounter, Jason. You know, because I have my own mm-hmm. that are so incredible. I wonder.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't, I have zero qualms or issues with that. I am one who is prone to believe the experiencer until proven mm-hmm. otherwise. And as you said, there are numerous cases of dinosaurs being seen in modern time. Whether you're looking at the possibility of the Thunderbird cases that have existed, mm-hmm. being modern pterosaurs, something like that. There are numerous.
And so for me, a lot of the reason I am willing to have this conversation is because, you know, with paranormal stuff, the size, the shape, like there's the things are always changing and morphing, right? But when it's a physical creature, when you have a bunch of disconnected people and they're all telling you the same details, right? Now, don't get me wrong. People are going to see different sizes. They're going to see slightly different colors. And let's face it, anything that has sexual dimorphism is going to be bigger. They'll have crests or not have crests. They'll have different colors depending on the sex. So you have to account for all that. And of course, just the shock of seeing something, right? That's not particularly something that's not supposed to live, not supposed to be in existence. You throw all that in there and you're like, okay, but are there key elements everyone mentions? And the answer is yeah, at least for the ones that I investigate. Because there's a lot of accounts that people have given me that I have put to the side and said, okay, I can't really verify this. Mm. Because there's too many things. There are connections that don't match. There are things that don't work. Or at the very least, I chalk them up to being something paranormal. Like, what do you do with gargoyles? And by the way, I've got a lot of accounts from very reputable people of something that could only be described as a gargoyle. But it's not a misidentified pterosaur. This thing's a friggin' gargoyle. It's like, okay, well,
yeah,
that goes on the pub. It's like, okay, well, I'll stick this on my gargoyle pile now, you know, and you move. 'Cause you're like, I don't know what to do with it. Like, that's not a thing, but you find the ones that, you know, the pterosaurs, you're like, okay, this is something I can wrap my brain around a little bit. And in the conversations are literally always go the same way. It's, I thought I was looking at a stork or a heron. I thought I was looking, or I thought my favorite one was a pelican because I love pelicans, right?
Sure.
And, but they always describe them the same way. It's like, but then I took a closer look. And that's when everything's like you said, the ontological shock, where it's like, oh, that's not what I thought it was at all. And the thing is, you have these accounts, and in unlike even Bigfoot, most people really don't want to talk about the pterosaur accounts. But people found me, and then I just started asking random people, "Have you ever seen anything weird?" And they'll say, "Okay, this is going to sound crazy, but I've seen a living pterosaur." And you're like, "Okay, I guess that's not the. It can't be that crazy if everyone in this, if so many people in the same areas are giving me the same stories."
Yeah,
and it's the same sort of accounts, and they're in a very similar, very very small pathway. In fact, you know, it looks like I think they may be coming to this area to probably procreate, lay eggs, and then they're moving out. and they're going out westward. Maybe they are getting bigger because you have some of these accounts further out, right? Close, you know, you go out into the desert, you head west. You have all these accounts of these giant nocturnal birds. And of course, the word bird is in quotation mark because they don't really know what they're looking at because there's not enough detail. But you have these accounts. Plenty of people said, look, all I know is it looks like a bird. Again, bird shape. It's a flying thing. But they're over their car. And the wings go over the side of a highway. And it's like, I don't know what it was, but it was flying. It looked like it had wings. And it's happening at night. These things do appear to be nocturnal. But they're often seen in the morning. The smaller ones are anyway. So, you know, the question is, do we have two different living species? One like a pteranodon where it's much, much larger and one smaller being the ramphractoid? Or does the ramphractoid get bigger and then to a point starts looking more like a pteranodon? Like, are they growing to that size and then they change their environment? Because we've seen that with a lot of reptiles, right? Sea turtles. They start off in one area, go to another. We've seen that with a lot of animals. They stay in the shallows, and then they join the large world when they're a big enough size. Sure. We just don't have that evidence. But what we do have, again, the reason, and I'm 30 seconds on any given day of saying it's all paranormal and moving on with my life. I really am. Because it's like, prove me wrong, right? It's, you know, everyone's like, well, would you shoot Bigfoot? I probably don't know if I'd shoot Bigfoot because I'd be worried about killing it. But a pterosaur, heck yeah. If I can shoot one, yes, because then I can bring it in and be like, here's the body. We're done. Right?
Yeah.
We've crossed that threshold. But it's, you know, it's like I said, I'm good 30 seconds away on any given day. But right now, the thing is, we do have a history of these things dying, of their bodies being recovered, of them being killed, and they show up in artwork. And going back to that idea of, you know, the book, I think I may have even...
I was showing the rock art just a minute ago. There's pottery with mm-hmm. dinosaurs, all kinds of things. And, you know, as opposed to... And one of the things specifically mm-hmm. about petroglyph panels, like what you see here, like not like the petroglyphs like what we talk about with Keith Sealand, of the Humaniverse that he's out investigating that mm-hmm. show much more than a typical hunting scene, things like that. These are the stories of creation, that kind of stuff with mm-hmm. gods and aliens. What you're seeing here are their panels of everyday life, images of hunt, images mm-hmm. of, you know, harvesting, that kind of stuff, and the animals that they ran across. And yeah, some of them are, well, pretty much dinosaurs when you look at them. Like, you could look at the one here on the top mm-hmm. left from Dinosaur National Monument and maybe be like, okay, well, you know, that's like an agama, you know, or something like that. Like, I'm a big reptile and amphibian mm-hmm. freak. That could be one of a thousand native species of reptile. However, when you get over to the right, and you start mm-hmm. looking at things that look like straight up long necked dinosaurs. I'd love to say, I guess Brachiosaur would be the closest thing because, the Brontosaurus is fake. Sorry, folks.
That
was an assemblage of various bones.
Yeah, they brought it back for its own thing based on the skull. But yeah, it's like Brontosaur, Brachiosaur. Well, it's a sauropod, right? The sauropod families, and there's a lot of these other things. But we have accounts throughout history of people killing these things. And people are like, oh, you mean the dragon slaying stories? Well, yes, I do. The problem is, though, most people associate these stories with these high mythologies, right? But there are accounts in law, right, in historical documents where it's like, no, we killed this thing. My favorite one is the Dragon of Rhodes, where it's during the Crusades. They have this European encampment. And, of course, this order of knights, of monk knights, are stationed on the island of Rhodes. And there was a dragon that was terrorizing people, right? It was eating things. And so they went out there to take care of it because they're knights. That's what they do. And they got slammed by this thing. And so one of the knights is like, and the guy who is the head Yeah, that's it. And the guy who was the head of the order said, we're not going to go after this thing. Our job is to hold roads because we're this is a military wing. That's what we're here to do. Everyone's ordered not to go after this thing. So this one knight goes, hold on one second. About that. That's that flu kicking. Thank you. So this one knight's not having any of it. So he goes AWOL, goes home, spends all of his money arming himself, and even creates this big mock-up of the dragon so he can shadow box this thing, right? He goes back, kills this thing. So he spent all of his wealth to arm himself with the appropriate armor and weaponry, and he ends up killing this thing. And they hang the head of this dragon on the wall of the city of Rhodes. But the I think it was the abbot, but or whoever was running that particular garrison with that particular monastic order said he actually had him locked up because he said you violated our order. I gave you orders. You went AWOL, right? Yeah, Helene. I can't even pronounce that. I'm not even going to try. So anyway, the dude. So yeah, it goes on.
De Villeneuve.
Thank you. Yes. And so he goes on and he writes a letter to the Pope and says, hey, I killed this thing, right? And I'm locked up because I violated orders. I think I should get a little bit of help, a little clemency here. The Pope pardons him, which is why he gets out. Again, as the end of the story is, he goes on to become head of the order. And he is the head of the order until his death. His grave exists. This is all recount. This isn't just mythology. This is written in the official records of this order. This is what happened. This is the history. This isn't some mythological story. Going back to the idea of using heraldic artwork to show that the Ramphractoid pterosaurs have been around for a while. There was a story in France where this, and this is the early late 1400s, early 1500s, this cattle farmer, you'd call him a rancher, but he didn't have enough horses or enough cattle to actually be a rancher. So he's still a farmer. He's leading his cows to get water at the river. Right. And this little dragon happens to be in the road. He doesn't want to hurt it, but it's hissing at his cattle and they're starting to get spooked. So he smacks it on the head with his stick and it dies. And he feels bad about it, but he takes it. He ends up taking it to Paris, to one of the universities there, and says, "Hey, I killed this small dragon. You know, accidentally. I didn't want to kill it, but it happened. Here you go." And so they end up putting this dragon on display. It is at this time, artistically, that what we think of as the dragon tail comes into heraldic artwork. Because when you say dragon tail, you think a long tail with a flange on the end, right? Like a triangular flange.
Yeah.
That did not exist in any heraldic artwork prior to that event. You can literally put a pinpoint when we start seeing dragons with that shaped, with that type of tail. Up until then, they look like snake tails or alligator tails or just any other reptile's tail. The flange comes in at that point. Now, flash forward about 100 years, three different artists over a 20-year time frame go to see this dragon. Now, the thing is, they all make, the bodies in various states of profound decay. And they draw this creature that had been on display. Now, the thing is, it's a gaffe, right? Well, the thing is, it's been 100 years. That means they probably made a gaffe. And we know it's a gaffe because we can literally identify what creatures were used to make the gaff. But the thing is, you make a gaff so it'll preserve, right? So the question then is, was that gaff based off of the original creature that had just, the body deposed or decomposed? And you look at the drawings, all three drawings have three very key features. One, the nose has a spike coming or a tooth coming out of the tip. The wings all, and it has one set of wings and one set of legs. The wings have three claws coming out of the bend in the wing, and it has a long tail. There's no flange on it because it's mostly bone at this point. Well, the question then becomes, is there any creature in history that matches that description? The answer is yes, the Ramphorhynchoid family of pterosaurs. In fact, their name means toothbeaked, because at the end of the species that we call Ramphorhynchus, which is what the whole family is named for, at the end of its snout is a tooth that comes out and makes it look like a beak. So what we have is the Ramphorhynchoid family tail comes into heraldic art at this time. 100 years after that, we have drawings made of, you know, over a 20-year period from three different artists, indicating that a gaff was made that had all the same features that go with a Ramphorhynchoid pterosaur. The obvious answer is that farmer killed a Ramphorhynchoid, and that its body was on display, and people said, okay, well, if this is a little dragon, then this is what dragon, these are the features we need to add to a dragon. That's why when you look at older recreations of wyverns, right, what do you see? Two legs, two wings, a long tail, flanged, and a snout that has a tooth on it coming out of the tip of it, because they all saw it and they started recreating these drawings, and they added it to heraldic art first, and then other artists picked up on that and started making their drawings based on that. So when you have those kinds of features, you're like, okay, that goes beyond coincidence, right?
Yeah.
And that's where we're at. We have accounts of people encountering other kinds of living dinosaurs, living dragons. You know, they just used the name dragon up until the 1800s.
Yeah.
Right? And so the question is it just that everyone happened to get really good with guessing what dinosaurs looked like? Or did they just encounter them in their everyday life? Well, I'm just going to go, I saw one. A bunch of people, some people I actually knew. I had known them for years, and they were like, okay, well, since you're talking about this, let me tell you what happened to me. And other people who, a person I know, this was after the book came out, thought I was crazy. Like, look, I love you, but I think this is nuts. And says, okay, question. On this date, can you see if anyone saw something like a Mothman? And I'm like, why? He goes, I don't want to talk about it. Come to find out, and this guy lives not even really half a mile from where I had my own encounter, and definitely only like 2 miles from where Rose and her daughter that's in the book saw their creature. But he lives right on, basically on that creek where I had my encounter. And he saw, and I drew out what he saw. He saw the pterosaur. Or at least a pterosaur. And he's the one who's like, look, I love you, but I can't believe this thing exists. And he's like, I don't know what to do with this. Like, this, I saw this thing broad daylight. Most of the sightings I recount and I cite are broad daylight. I have two that are at night, but the thing passes in front of their headlights. And so they get a good look at it. Most encounters of the people that I will actually cite publicly are during the day, again, usually very early morning before noon. So it's like people are seeing these things. We have accounts of them dying and being killed throughout history. I'm going to assume that these are living, breathing creatures. It's just a very, very small population of them.
Yeah.
I think it's the easiest solution to the problem, right? Again, like I said, I'm 30 seconds away from from saying it's all paranormal, moving on with my life. But the problem is, I look at the evidence and I say, well, hold on. We have people giving very consistent accounts, people who are unconnected and people who are non-believers, and they're giving very consistent stories of coloration, size, form throughout history. We have accounts of them being killed. This sounds like a living, breathing population, just very, very small.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And when you're talking about animals like that, when you're talking about things like Mokalium bimbe, that kind of stuff, you're talking about a long-lived species. I mean, even crocodiles, things like that, live into the multiple hundreds of years.
Yeah, exactly. And particularly if you're dealing with So again, dinosaurs are fall into a couple different categories. Again, pterosaurs are living, are just reptiles, but you know, the sauropods, they could have lived, you know, we have no idea how long they could live. And I think the thing is, for me, drop the word, you know, forget the word dinosaur. There are plenty of animals that should not exist if the mainstream story is true, right? Because I think there are several dragons that are probably something like Megalania, which was just a giant Komodo dragon, essentially. But it's a Komodo dragon the size of a bus. Like, that's a big Komodo dragon. We have other accounts of other creatures that are supposedly long extinct, but they're hanging around, at least within the last 2,000 years, last 1,500 years, last couple hundred years. You know, that begs a lot of questions. All I want is all the evidence on the table. Again, if it's all paranormal, great, cool. I'm groovy with that answer. It doesn't bother me what it is, but I'd like to know what it is. I'd like to know where it fits in the grand scheme of things. Right now, there's sufficient evidence to think that there are animals bopping around, just doing what they do, and they just don't look like they fit in our world. Okay, well, if this is real and they are living creatures and they shouldn't be here, that begs the question, well, what are they doing here? What does that tell us about the world that we actually live in?
Yeah.
That's the only thing that matters to me because, you know, all of these things are fun, but they aren't an end unto themselves, right? Like, the day after we find and prove Bigfoot, you know, if there is a Bigfoot and the other stuff's paranormal, you know.
What then?
I'm like, okay, cool, great. I'm going to move on because.
Yeah, do we have a plan of action?
Yeah.
For the day that we find him? You know, and the same thing with this, you know, and there are many out there, especially in our communities who call out things like Smithsonian, stuff like that for, you know, hiding of skeletons, hiding of history, things like that. I wouldn't doubt that at some point there was some of that. But there are numerous cases of modern sightings of dinosaurs in the Amazon, in the Congo, here in America, all kinds of things.
Oh yeah. Papua New Guinea. Alaska. I mean, again, basically these things are all over the place, right? And that's the deal. They are everywhere. Most cultures have some encounter of their own little oddity that has survived and dealt with it. And again, these things are not they're not an end unto themselves. I just want to know the shape of the world, so to speak. And I think that tells us more about the world that we actually live in. In some of these stories that you hear and you're like, okay, this is a real story. This is something that really happened to somebody, but what do you do with it? Right. One of the creatures on the cover of the book, there's an account of that happened here in the Trinity, not technically in the Metroplex, but you know, it's close enough. Dude was fishing and he's sitting there fishing in the Trinity River. And this creature raises its head up out of the water and just looks at him. And the guy described it as sort of like an ichthyosaur, but it just sort of stuck its head up and looked at him. But he describes it as having sort of like a longer neck, but a long, narrow snout. So I think it's probably something like a mosasaur where it had flippers or legs that it could push down and raise itself up out of the water and look at him.
Sure.
But, you know, it looks at him and he's thinking this thing, it's like if it wanted, it could reach over, snag him and pull him in the water. There's nothing he could do about it because he's frozen. It just sort of looks at him and then puts his head back in the water and disappears. It's like, what do you do? And he wouldn't fish there ever again.
Wow.
He doesn't want anything to do with it. This happened in the 70s. He's like, what do you, and I'm like, well, what do you do with that? Again, same thing with like the whole, my gargoyle pile that I've got going. It's like, okay, it's a gargoyle pile. I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah.
But we have accounts of sea monsters that do fit the description of mosasaurs. Right, that fit the description of other living, you know, what we would assume, what they're not, again, not technically dinosaurs, but are associated with that era, right? With that realm. It's like you have them, they're here. What is it?
Yeah.
And if we know what they are, if we can pin what they are, then I think that tells us the world we live in. That's why it matters.
Yeah. Yeah, no, precisely. And I mean, there was a story not too long ago about a Carnival cruise that was possibly stalked by a Mosasaur. There's all kinds of things. I mean, even the one that we refer to regularly when it comes to cryptids, things like that, is the fact of the coelacanth.
Yes, exactly.
Something that was in fossil record that was utterly extinct until the 1970s, 60s? 30s. Was it the 30s when they started pulling them out of the coast of Africa? We know that there is a large breeding population of them.
Yeah, there's two large breeding populations, one off the coast of Japan, one off the coast of Madagascar. And it's like, these things aren't as extinct as you think.
Yeah.
Well, that may be true for a few other critters running around, right? Yeah. And in the past, we called them dragons, you know, we called them what we called them at the time, and now we call them dinosaurs. And so the thing is, though, they aren't supposed to be here. They don't fit the modern paradigm, and so they are ignored. Because and people who want to talk about them and say, look, I had this encounter, they're shoved out of the story because it's not supposed to be there, according to the people who make those decisions. But at some point, someone's going to get one, right? And they're going to bring it in, and it's going to be undeniable. Now, the question is, what do we do with that, right? I don't think we live in a world where that can necessarily be disappeared, right, anymore. But I do question how quickly will people, discount it or discredit it, or will it be accepted? And at which point, there's going to be some people who have some very uneasy questions to answer, which is, what is it still doing here, unchanged?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, precisely. I'm showing an image right now, an article about the Gulf sturgeons that were found in the Mississippi River. These things grow. They're like gar. They grow to 5-6 feet long, a few hundred pounds. But they are pretty well unchanged for the last 200 million years. That was their last known point of evolution, according to the fossil record. So even when you look at things like the platypus existed at the same time as the dinosaurs. It and the crocodile made it out of the same era. Same with sturgeon, everything else. So all these things existed at the same time. To think that some species made it out and others didn't, I think is a little silly. Especially when you're talking about a long-lived species, once again, that can live for multiple hundreds of years. I mean, geez, if I remember the Galapagos turtle at the Houston Zoo when I was a kid that was a hundred something, few hundred years old almost.
Yeah, there's one, I think it's in, I want to say it's in Britain. It may be somewhere else, though, but it's like 180 years old.
Yeah.
It's like this thing has literally seen it was around to see the end of slavery and is still hanging out today.
And it's not like in its entire lifetime of captivity that it's been romping around trying to have sex, or that it would be romping around trying to have sex on a seasonal basis in the wild. That is maybe a once to twice a lifetime situation.
Yeah. No, exactly. And that's so, yeah. I mean, the simple fact of the matter is, we have accounts of these things forever. We've always had them. It's only in modernity. In fact, really, up until the turn of the last century and a little after, people seriously, they took these accounts and these stories seriously. It's only been, it was really post-World War I where people stopped talking about this in a serious scientific level because, again, the what sort of became the dominant mainstream paradigm did not allow for their existence. And that's the issue, is that these things do call a lot of things and a lot of assumptions into question. And that's a question that a lot of people don't want answered. Like the fact that we have soft tissue in dinosaur bone is an uncomfortable fact. The fact that we have active hemoglobin. Like, the reason we know for a fact that Tyrannosaurus rex is related to chickens is because of the hemoglobin. We were able to run tests on it and actually and see what kind of antigens it would respond with. These are uncomfortable facts.
Yeah.
For the modern mainstream. And just like the existence of any of these things, the reason they're sort of, they've become Fortiana is because the mainstream science doesn't want to look at them because they are uncomfortable for them. Because there's a mainstream narrative that if it's called into question is going to cause some people who made a lot of money off of that idea, it's going to cause them some heartburn. And yeah. I forget who said it. I always forget who says this. That's why I write everything down. But they said that science advances with every I'm going to blow up, but essentially science advances with every gravesite. That essentially you have that you have these ideas and that the paradigm is that's in vogue. Everyone does their work within the paradigm. And the paradigm doesn't shift until enough people have died that new people can bring in new paradigms and work from that. And that's the situation we find ourselves in. It's just the current paradigm does not allow for these things. So no work is done in them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, precisely. And once again, just to take it back to the beginning of the conversation and the conversation we've had so many times since MUFON this year is everything, it's much like there are numerous brands of tissue out there. Facial mm-hmm. tissue, rear end tissue, everything else. Call most of it Kleenex. There's numerous ways to make a copy of something. They're all called a Xerox.
Exactly.
You know? And we tend to throw everything into these catch-all bins mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. that's the problem is that, once again, when it ends up in a catch-all bin like that, there are certain scientists who ain't gonna play with it and ain't gonna look at it. And I'm not going to speak for Jeff Meldrum or anything like that. He has an amazing volume of work when it comes mm-hmm. to primates in North America, things like that, and a hominid primate species. However, I would venture a guess that he might have varying opinions if you came to him talking about Bigfoot coming out of a portal. And we've had the conversation on the show. I am not opposed to the conversation. I am not opposed to the witnesses, the thought form. My curiosity is much like yours. Is it something else that is taking advantage of the tropes in our mind that we would be comfortable with?
Exactly.
And the fact of, yes, there is a physical hominid species, but there's also this other that is mm-hmm. using paranormal means.
Right. Well, and that's my thing, right? With a lot of these encounters, you take a quick look and you're like, okay. Yeah, so let me throw myself under my own bus on this one, right?
Absolutely. You have to be willing to.
So let me hurl myself here. Let me mean girls myself as if anyone saw that movie, they know what I mean.
Here's your ticket.
Yeah, exactly. So where I had my encounter, right? DeSoto, Texas, it's not that far from a actual perspective from the highest point in Cedar Hill, Texas, which is called Witch Mountain. OK. There is a number of ghost lights in the area. They're famous in that area. They've been there for a while. And over the last year, I've gotten several accounts of light of unidentified lights, very low, so they're not just unidentified planes in that area, right around that area, including from the friend who didn't believe in any of this. I was there when we both saw a light. And it's like, he's like, what is that? And I'm like, I don't know. I can't identify it. But I've had other people in the area saying, like, I was in Grand Prairie looking towards here and I saw this thing over here. And other people are seeing these things all in that same area. That creek that I had my encounter has there seems to be a tradition of Bigfoot in that area, right? The people who, the Bigfoot that looked over the fence at the small child.
Yep.
They're off of that same creek.
The Hinky Man of Ten Mile Creek.
Yeah, right, the Hinky Man of Ten Mile Creek. Look at that.
We've talked about it before, still bookmarked from previous conversations.
Yes. Yeah, the Hinky Man. Like, it's like, so it's all connected to that area, right? Yeah. And essentially where Ten Mile Creek starts, technically, connects to other things that are right around that area. So I'm over here and I got to ask myself, okay, so we do have people seeing this, what appears to be a living creature, but we're all right next to and butting up to Witch Mountain where we have lights. Now, I talk about in the book is the, you'll want to go, you'll want to go closer in. There you go. North of Red Oak. There you go. So, yeah, Lancaster is, that's part of it right there. Ten Mile Creek Preserve. I actually have a friend of my daughter's lives over there. So that's part. And so the thing is, it has a lot of branches, right, that run all over that area. And so it's like we have all this in this one area. I got to ask. So actually, my encounter was further west from there. You go across 35. Yeah, just keep going. Keep going. Stop. Oh, that's 35. Yeah, keep going. You're way in. Yeah, keep going west. Keep going west. Keep going. Because, you're not that far. And just slightly further north. Yeah, keep going. Yeah, it's the Tom Thumb 10-mile drive. Keep going. Yes. Okay, Pleasant Run. Wintergreen. Okay, so where I lived. Yes, so
many more fingers on the creek there than over there.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, Thorn Tree Golf Club, literally where I was just a little bit east of there, where Weatherford, where Westmoreland is, where you see Meadowbrook Estates. Essentially, that's where I was, in that area. And so if you scroll just a little bit further west, you'll see, essentially, go down a little bit. Mm-hmm. So where it says 10 Mile Creek Estates, go a little bit west of that. Okay, so you're basically in the area of, you go a little bit further west. So yeah, that other creek, that all connects to the 10 Mile. Like this thing goes everywhere. If you go a little bit further, you'll get to Witch Mountain. Where that Home Depot is, and then just go left a little bit more. Yeah. Okay, stop right there. Essentially, in that area, that's Witch Mountain. You know, so there's not a lot of people, a lot of streets over there, because you can't, because it's basically inhospitable. But the areas around it, you see the creek that's running through there. This is all elevated position. Like this is all very, very high up in a lot of ways, because what happens is it looks like from the east, it looks like it's a subtle slope up. But then you have this massive drop off. It's literally called the Cedar Ridge. It runs from essentially Dallas all the way down to much further south than even Italy. Alvarado really is about where it stops. So you have this area where there's this sudden drop off. Okay, you can make the argument that if pterosaurs light up, and there's reasons with like the rope in to think that maybe these ghost lights are actually the pterosaurs at night, right? They're mostly nocturnal. That could be an answer. But at the same time, it's like, well, but what if all of this stuff is just different manifestations of a paranormal phenomena that's hiding what it is? I can't discount that. Until we have a body.
Yeah.
I can't discount that this is simply another form this thing is taking. Let's look at Dogman for a second, right? I mean, you look at a lot of the early stories, this is clearly a paranormal entity running around. In Linda Godfrey's book, again, the story everyone points to, that's like, hey, I mean, look at how it's associated with graveyards and things like that. There's a story where the night watchman at a graveyard, you know, it sees this thing and it turns around, looks at him and says Gadara, which is the area in the New Testament where Jesus casts out the demons. It's like this thing is clearly connected to the paranormal. And we have a lot of these stories of things. If you're telepathically talking to something, if it's disappearing in front of you, I'm sorry, I don't recall reading anywhere in anything Jane Goodall wrote about how the orbs would show up, right? While she was out there hanging out with the gorillas.
Yeah.
Right? If things are disappearing, if they are reappearing, if they're talking to you telepathically, if they're shape-shifting, maybe the issue is what you're seeing is not what you think you're seeing. Kiel very famously asked if we could objectively observe some of these abductions, would we see a UFO and little green men and all him in the guy being taken up, or would we see someone essentially in a trance? Yeah. Right? We don't know. We don't really have a way of observing that. And when you throwing the UFO or UAP community back in on this, we have hundreds of accounts of people ending their encounters by calling out on Jesus, or having years of encounters ended through traditional
Ones, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So the question then becomes, okay, again, does that account for all of it? No, of course not. I think the government's way more involved than we even want to think about on that. Mm. I think they want us to think that they want us to believe in UFOs because they've got their own agenda. But that's a whole other episode. My point is, when you put all the evidence on the table, you start seeing that some of this stuff isn't what it's trying to pass itself off as, right? Yeah. That was Jacques Vallée's point. That was John Keel's point. That's so many other people's points, saying, hey, whatever this phenomena is, it's not what it passes itself off as. Well, that doesn't necessarily have to just stay with, UFOs and UAPs. That may fall into a lot of what we consider cryptozoology to be.
Sure.
Again, trust me, it would make me really happy for Bigfoot to be a physical thing, for all of the pterosaurs to be a physical thing. It would very much make my worldview easier. However, if there are things running around that maybe don't want us to know what it is all the time, that's a really, really good way to hide your activity, is to appear to be something that we want to see, right?
Yep.
That fits our worldview, that causes us to, let's bring it back to Bigfoot. When someone sees a Bigfoot, what do? We immediately run out to the area and we investigate. And then we buy little figurines of Bigfoot. We wear Bigfoot t-shirts. We sing Bigfoot songs. We go and talk on podcasts about Bigfoot. You know, it's like, okay.
Do you know Bigfoot songs, Jason?
You don't ever want to hear me sing anything, but I don't know them personally. I
want to hear you sing a Bigfoot song.
I don't know any Bigfoot songs, but I know they exist. I'll be honest with you. I have never once sung a Bigfoot song, but they do exist.
I guarantee you they exist.
Okay. Have you ever seen Willow Creek?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. There's a Bigfoot song on there. Yeah. So, by the way, that is my favorite Bigfoot movie. I love that one. But yeah, it's like, so the question then becomes, well, why would they want to hide as something like, say, a Bigfoot or a pterosaur? Well, outside of the fact that now we've chalked up the encounter with something else, right? So it's hiding its motions.
Yep.
Where's the line between research and worship? I mean, that's a question I ask myself a lot. And the problem is, I'm uncomfortable because I don't know where that line is.
It's hard. It's hard. It's hard to make that definition, man, because and it's something that, I mean, a lot of this show is having the uncomfortable conversation, mm-hmm. Jason, which is why I'm not afraid to go here. A lot of our communities is want of confirmation.
Yes.
And I'm even saying this as somebody who was brought up with a full-on religious background. I am a former Catholic seminarian. I am a former assistant youth minister, taught CCE for a decade of my life, taught confirmation during that decade, RCIA, all kinds of things. However, that in the same right is want of confirmation. No different. It is want to belong with people who have had the same revelation that you have had, who have had the same finding of truth that you have had, a gathering of people in a like space at a common time who have a common belief. And I had a guest put it very beautifully on my show a couple weeks ago, and I have stolen it. I don't believe, or because that implies faith.
Yes.
I know. I know the things that have happened to me. I don't believe that they happened to me. I know they happened to me. You know, because otherwise it means that I have faith that is what happened. No. Much like you and your pterosaur sighting, it may be something that I have questions about to this day, but I know it.
Yeah. Well, and that's, and again, you know, we've talked about this a lot. It's, in a lot of ways, this is a replacement for many people. It becomes a replacement for religion.
Yeah, it can.
And they'll even say, yeah, and it's like, which is why I say this, none of these things can be an end unto themselves, right?
Yeah.
Like I said, my goal in this field is, I believe that these things, once understood, give us more understanding of our universe.
Absolutely.
That's why I care. I care about history because it tells us about where we came from, right? Yep. Care about science because that's helping us understand the world that we live in. These things, paranormal, physical, everything in between, once understood, tells us about about the universe we live in.
Yeah.
That's the higher goal. Because again, I think what we find at the end of that, right, for me, is God.
Yeah.
Like that's yeah. So again, I've always said where I'm coming from on this. This is my perspective. I think the biblical worldview explains everything that we actually see much more coherently. Mm-hmm. Now the problem is though, but again, that's my opinion. But that's the
rectifying the biblical worldview can be part of the problem.
Exactly. Like, what are our
incongruencies even within that conglomeration of documents in and of itself can be a problem to take on when it comes to that.
Yeah, we have to be willing to put everything on the table, right? And that's and the issue is, when you put everything on the table, what do you come to? What are the evidences? Let's have the conversation. Which is why I like you. I am not a fan of things that are just like, okay, so we have this information, but we can't tell you where we got it or how we got it. You just have to trust that it's true.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Then I'm out. You want to put everything on the table?
Yeah.
Great. Then we'll talk. Let's talk about this.
Yep. Well, and it's like the conversation we were having pre-show, Jason, the fact of, you know, being willing to have that conversation and being like, people call me a skeptic in some groups, like I think it's a dirty word. Feel free to call me a skeptic. Call me a capital S skeptic, because the true job of a skeptic is to be weighing all sides of the equation, to be taking in all points of datum into a data set and looking for the point of datum that makes them go, well, I'll be damned. There it is.
Exactly.
I've been That's looking how it's supposed for that to work. Opinion absolutely changed. Like that is my job. Even like I don't consider myself a researcher, like in the traditional sense. I consider myself much more like Graham Hancock, where he's like, you can shoot any holes in my research you want. It's not research. I'm a journalist.
Right. Exactly.
I'm covering research that other people are doing, which just happens to be pointing here. You know?
Exactly.
Like I've just had the conversation with hundreds of people, man, you know, and this seems to be where the conversation goes regularly.
Yeah.
From numerous points of view and from numerous spokes on the paranormal wheel.
No, 100%. One of the illusion or the metaphor I always use is, if we were walking down a road, right, and we saw a bunch of stones, perfectly round spheres in the ground, and they were arranged in I always forget the number. I think it's 9. Anyway, but they're arranged in a triangular pattern, perfect triangle, right? Perfectly spherical, and they all have 5 impressions on them. And we say, okay, how did this get here? But we cannot consider human intervention. Mm. Well, that's not science anymore. Because someone can look and say, well, hold on, They're perfectly spherical.
Yeah.
They're arranged in a perfect triangle. Those five indentations indicate the five triangles you can make out of this alignment. So why can't we consider human intervention? Well, because now it's ideology. Because for whatever reason, human intervention is off the table. Well, the problem is that's the world we live in. We have all this phenomena going on. And they, in the mainstream, and not just the mainstream, but in the 14 fields, everyone's saying you can't consider this, right? This thing is what you can't consider. This phenomena you can't take into account. You can look at this phenomena, but can only be seen from this perspective. That's not going to lead to truth. That just leads to dogma. And that's the problem, is we have a lot of people who, you know, again, all across the field, regardless of what the story
people like
is.
Dogma.
Yeah.
Jason.
Oh.
Dogma gives you order.
Yes. Well, and that's the thing is, I've said this for a long time. This is not science versus religion. It's religion versus religion.
Yeah.
That's all this is.
Yeah.
Because the science data is just the data.
Nothing more than modern religion in so many aspects.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the lockdown of science and the refusal to study things, the further want of confirmation of the known instead of the figuring of the known quantitative or unknown quantitative rather.
Well, it's not just even what you can explore. It's okay. Well, you can explore this phenomena, but you can only explore it from this perspective. Yeah. Only ideas and theories from this perspective are acceptable.
Yeah.
Again, that's all dogma, and all I want is all the data on the table so we can look at it and say, what does this actually tell us about the world? That's my only call. That's all I want.
Yeah.
Because I think once we do that, we can start piecing some things together. Until that happens, we can't really know.
Yeah, no. And I tend to agree with you in that, right? Because, you know, I say it at the end of the show all the time, my sign out, the fact of it takes open hearts and open minds. You know, and that even means a heart open enough to be crushed, Jason. It may be the 100%. Fact that what you hold to be true is not, and you may have to be ready for that. You know,
100%.
And those things are once again moments of ontologic shock. You know, when you had your experience. On the banks of that creek fishing and seeing that creature flying through the air, it changed everything that you knew to be.
Yeah. I mean, it did. And it's like, and I wouldn't have, I mean, it really took me, it's only been very recently I could say that it did, because I spent most of my life trying to say it didn't happen.
Mm.
Because I couldn't believe that something like, and again, I go back to, how crazy and stupid am I? I'm hearing stories of these things existing in Texas. But again, Texas is really big for those of you who don't understand.
Yeah.
It's really, really big. So something existing in South Texas does not mean it's going to exist in North Texas. But it's like, I believed these things existed at the time. I just couldn't believe they existed where I was. And I will bet you a lot of people have that encounter that isn't supposed to be there. And the first thing they think is, well, maybe these things are real, but they can't be real where I live, because I live here. This is not exotic. You know, I don't live in some far off exotic place. You know, I live in Dallas, Texas. I live in Oklahoma. I live in wherever. Right. I live in Averageville, USA, and nothing weird happens here except for Uncle Merle and his meth habit. Right. And so when the weird things happen, they write it off. They find some way of saying that, of compartmentalizing it and just saying, okay, that what, you know, I saw a bear, I saw a meth head, I must have been dreaming or something. They find a way to write it off. I'm just one of those people who couldn't find a way to write it off. I tried 20 years. I tried. And then eventually I got to that point where I couldn't write it off because other people had had that encounter. Funny thing is, as soon as I came out doing what I do, how many people came out? Again, at church, it was like, okay, so I got to tell you something. I'm like, I have known you for 20 years. Where in the hell was this story? You know?
Yeah.
And it's like, but it's because they know that if they tell that story, they become persona non grata. my estimation is that most people have a story of the impossible, of the thing that's not supposed to be.
Yeah.
And they don't tell it because they know as soon as they do, they become the crazy person. Well, I'm starting to think the problem is we got a lot of really sane people in a very insane world, and we're all trying to match and fit in with a crazy with the crazies.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the reality is that truth is stranger than fiction, Jason.
Yeah, it is.
The world around us shows us that every single day. Mm-hmm. It never ceases to amaze me. I know you're on social media. I post stories all day long to the Curious Realm group, and some of the things that I have seen over the last just 5 years of that group and doing things and covering news the way that we have are phenomenal. And it's crazy to see where our world has come to. It's crazy to see where our communities in the world, the paranormal, have come to in the last 5 years, where we have come to in the search for disclosure, where we have come to in the search for cryptid evidence, in proof of things like remote viewing beyond statistic.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Amazing things. So,
by the way, do you see the wavy lines? I know I you got that reference. Sign. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. You can keep the $5. I'm out of here.
I'm out of here.
Jason, man, thank you so much for coming on, as always. I love our conversations into this stuff because it is these conversations that we have to have within these communities. We have to be willing to stretch across the aisle. We have to be willing to hear the thought forms of other people openly and unabashedly.
Yes, 100%. Again, that's why I love your show, Chris, and I'm always glad to be on.
Well, thank you so much. Let everybody know where they can go and follow you, like, subscribe, where they can go to get your books, of course, other than the Curious Realm store, curiousrealm.com/store.
Well, of course, always go to the Curious Realm store, but all my work is basically on Amazon. I have a whole little page there. You can look up and see all of my misspent time. At the moment, I have retired from podcasting, which I'm clearly doing a terrible job of, considering all the shows I've been on recently.
You aren't doing yours, though.
Yeah, I'm not doing mine. I'm not doing mine.
Conversations in the world all day long.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, but I am working on some more books, some comics and things like that. And then I'm going to get that. I got a few things like I'm working on Choopy Rules. It was the TikTok thing I did for a little bit, but it's a comic book. It's going to be a lot of fun. And then I'll get back to doing some more serious, some more serious work. But yeah, I'm doing that right now. So yeah, again, you can follow me on Facebook and Instagram. I'm hanging out. I will post things periodically as I get. I'm kind of taking some time to do some things around the house and get my sea legs back. But yeah, again, Facebook, and again, yeah, my channels, Ciru Papers and Jason McLean Questions Everything, that's still out there. I haven't taken them down. I'm just not going to be putting anything to them. But, you know, as things happen, I guess I'll post and let everyone know, hey, a book is out or whatever. But yeah, and again, you know what, guys? You love Chris. Stay with Chris, because as soon as my books come out, you know he's going to hop on and have me on here to yell at me.
That's right. That's right. We'll talk about him until the sun comes up, buddy. I can't wait. I'm so glad to hear that you are getting back to writing and into projects that you love and that fulfill you. That is so entirely important. So I'll be sharing links, all that kind of good stuff. Take care of yourself, my friend. Thanks so much for taking the time and coming on tonight.
Oh, no, I appreciate it, man. Really appreciate it. Love your show. Be good.
Talk to you soon, bud. Always a great conversation with Jason McLean. Once again, to know that we can reach across communities. We can be open-minded to each other's experiences, to each other's experiences in the paranormal, to how those experiences change us, move us, and change the way that we interact with society. When we come back from our commercial break, our guest is the amazing Lem Buchanan. Lem Buchanan is, of course, well known for his involvement with the government's Stargate remote viewing program. We will talk about how he came to be involved with that program, how he came to be incorporated into the world of remote viewing for intelligentsia gathering, and exactly what remote viewing's all about. I have officially started my remote viewing journey with Lem Buchanan. I cannot wait to find out more and more about this amazing science and mental martial art. Our interview with Lem Buchanan coming up right after this, folks. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing,
to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies. Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultational workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that commercial break. Thank you so much to all of our sponsors, especially WebWorks Wireless. Without WebWorks, I've got a WebWorks Wireless router right here from my live stream kit. And this is it, folks. This is what runs our live stream every Wednesday night, things like that. They provide you with your own router. You have unlimited internet. I have never been throttled. I have never been stopped. That is your home for no throttle, no speed checking, no credit checking internet for your home, business, camper, camp, all kinds of things. Anywhere that you have cell phone signal, you will have internet, folks. Stop on by and check them out at webworkswireless.com. Our guest in this segment is founder of CRV Training and Services. The website is crviewer.com. He is also the author of the book, The Seventh Sense, remote viewer, Lynn Buchanan. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Okay. How are you doing?
Doing fantastic, man. I have been nice and busy on the road doing all kinds of fun stuff. And while I was on the road, actually had a chance to chat with Tracy Dolan for a few minutes, and we got to talking about you and remote viewing. And whenever I landed back over here, I was like, you know, I need to contact Lynn. It has been too long since we've had him on the show, and
you bet.
It seems like the topic of remote viewing has been popping up and popping up and popping up in my life. And when that happens, I tend to listen, Lynn.
You pay attention.
I only take so many bludgeons over the head before I actively pay attention to things. So it was one of those moments where I was like, it is time to talk about this. Because we are coming up against, we are now currently in a roiling point of society. We are beyond the point of a frog in a boiling pot. Everything is coming to a head in so many communities. And, when it comes to remote viewing, it is interesting to see how that is creeping back up in popularity with so many people.
Well, yeah, it's becoming of great interest, because of the work that we've been doing most of it in the background. There's been a lot of fluff and woo woo and all that on the internet.
Yeah.
But the, people who have been doing the controlled remote viewing are largely staying in the background, working for businesses, working for police departments, working for research and all that, and staying away from all the woo-woo and the craziness of the internet, of Facebook, you know. And as a result, the results of what we're doing is gaining a lot of respect. And that's what we want. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's to see the number of people, I say it pretty regularly on the show. Whenever I go to IRVA every year, that is probably the conference that I attend more than anything, where just about everybody that speaks has a comma and letter behind their names. They are all doctors of something, be it, you know, laser physics, psychology, sociology, what have you. It is interesting how it runs the gamut there. And at the same mm-hmm. token, when it comes to paranormal, remote viewing is fully and quantifiably provable by more than just statistic.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And to know that the federal government spent millions of dollars for years, spread over decades, doing research into this. How did you first get pulled into the government's Stargate program?
General Stubblebine, the head of the U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command. I've always had a PK ability.
Hmm.
I have had largely suppressed it all my life, but when I get angry, it comes out. And one day I had done this massive, massive computer program that tied the intelligence services of 12 different countries together, got their computers talking to each other. This other sergeant had wanted that job, but I got it. And so when I was demonstrating it to the commanding generals of those countries, I did my little, pre-talk and all that, and hit the enter key, and the computer went dead. And they all started laughing at me, and I looked up, and this other sergeant was at the back door and mouthed, "Gotcha," and turned around and left. I got flaming angry, and when I did, I hear that the total estimate was around $50 million worth of computers just went down all over the place.
Wow.
And General Stubblebine got wind of this. He wanted to start a unit that would destroy enemy computers. And so he brought me to D.C., pulled me out of Germany where I was, brought me to D.C., and proposed that to Congress for funding. Congress said, not no, but, hell no. that sounds like mind control. We're not getting caught with that again.
Mm.
And so they wouldn't fund it. So he took me out to the remote viewing unit and put me in there. And he introduced me to the remote viewing unit. And, and I said, that's crazy. The military didn't do this kind of stuff, but they did. And that's where I stayed the rest of my military career. And I loved it. It was the most interesting job I've ever had in my life.
Well, and as you were saying, this this program came on the heels of things like MK Ultra, stuff like that.
Oh yeah,
and yeah. There was a great fear for quite a few, I mean, even electronic programs that were out there.
Yeah.
That was the beginning of voice to skull technology, all kinds of things that we talk about regularly on this show. And as you were saying, they were worried more about things like remote influencing, that kind of stuff. Actively influencing heads of state or military people, things like that. Was that something that was ever focused on by the unit, Lynn?
Oh, no. In fact, we had an edict. No active mental work, only passive mental work. We were there to collect intelligence, and that was it. And, a lot of people think, the remote viewing unit, they spied on us. We were forbidden. First of all, Presidential Order 11905, then that was superseded by 12333, forbid us, absolutely forbid us to do remote viewing intel collection on U.S. citizens.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah. Wow. I mean, we could have gone to jail for that. We would not do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you said, interestingly enough, even though used by the military, not used for typical military means, like it wasn't used to debilitate enemies in the field. It wasn't used to, you know, they weren't trying to use psychic spies to destroy the enemy's mind or anything like that.
Oh, no, no. We were collecting intelligence and providing that intelligence into the intelligence effort, where it went into sort of a mixing pot of spy in the sky, ground agents, ELINT, you know, electronic intelligence, human intelligence, and all that. And ours just went into the mixing pot and had a, you know, had an influence on the decisions that the intelligence efforts would make as to what they were going to have policy, troops do, and all that. But no, we never did. We did collection only, period. Yeah,
just it's simple reconnaissance, nothing more.
That's right. Yeah,
and you know, you say simple, but the protocols of remote viewing. Now, you are actually one of the people that I discuss regularly on the show, Lynn. And that is for the fact of, though we all have a propensity to be psychic, and some people, much like running, you know, are better at that naturally than other people. You know, and hey, I could probably work out every day of my life and never be as fast as Flojo, you know, because she just has a natural athletic ability toward that. Some people have a natural athletic ability toward being psychic, toward being a medium, toward being clairvoyant. And yes, that can get better. That can get more accurate. But you can't necessarily train somebody, to be clairvoyant. You can train anybody to remote view through protocol controlled remote viewing.
Yeah, clairvoyant is, you know, the remote viewing the CRV, controlled remote viewing of Inga Swan, encompasses clairvoyance, clairaudience, tactics, whatever you, tactiles, whatever you call that. Because it is based actually on the idea that your body can act as a translator between your subconscious, which is psychic, and your conscious, which is not psychic. And so what you actually do in controlled remote viewing is you taste the target, you feel it, you touch it, you see it, you look at it, you look at its colors and things like that, and you describe it physically because you're getting those physical sensations.
Yeah.
And so you're getting them, of course, from your subconscious mind, because what it teaches you to do is to communicate with your own subconscious. And so through the body. And so it's actually very much a martial art.
Well, and that's just it. It is, as you say, the best martial art. It is the mental of the mental martial arts, and the idea that that this is a skill that you can hone and get better and better at. And once again, you don't have to be somebody who is a natural psychic to be able to remote view.
That is
remarkable. Now granted, we all have the abilities inside of us. But
there were a lot of teachers out there saying, you know, if you learn remote viewing, we can make you psychic. Well, that's false advertising, because you, at the subconscious level, you already are psychic.
Yeah.
You just have to learn how to get that information to your conscious mind and then out on a piece of paper into a customer, you know, who needs it.
Yeah. Well, and I think that of anything is what the Marshall science part of controlled remote viewing does, is it gets you no different than a seminary experience gets you closer to a point of ecstatic prayer. Through regular meditation, things like that. This kind of does the same thing, where it brings you to a point of, if you're following these, then you are following the protocols to connect your conscious and subconscious together.
That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to explore something. I was chatting with my wife literally before we came on the show, Lynn, and I have this propensity, and I've said it for years. If I can see it in front of me,
mm-hmm.
I can build it. Like yeah. if I can in my mind's eye see an object, like something that I want to make, create, what have mm-hmm. you. I can make it happen or come pretty close. A lot of this I put down to, I guess, the modern concept of manifestation, you know, mm-hmm. the idea of putting something out there and kind of making your reality to match that, to speak. How akin to that is remote viewing? Because one of the things she said was, oh, well, it's not like you can remote view the future. I was like, oh, hold on. I was like, nah, that is not what quantum entanglement teaches us. And that is definitely not what all physics, by the laws that we gave time its definition, past, future, everything else. Like, all of this is just an agreed upon illusion, whether it's time or the reality that we're living in. So, let's get into that idea of remote viewing past events, remote viewing future events, and how that is possible, Lynn.
Yeah. Remote viewing past events is simple and easy. You pass the information to the subconscious mind, move back 10 years. Now, present tense, tell me what you are seeing, because the conscious mind works present tense. And so the subconscious moves back 10 years. It has no problem with that, and tells you what it is presently seeing, and you write it down on paper. And you can do the same for the future, move forward in 10 years. One of the things that we point out to beginning students is, we'll have a picture in a sealed envelope, and we'll tell them, okay, describe the picture. And they will describe the picture, with the training, they will describe the picture. And then we open the envelope and they've described the picture. And we say, you realize, of course, that you saw your feedback at a future time. You described what you were going to see in a few minutes. And there are a lot of people out there who say, oh, you can't view the future accurately and all that, because the future does change. But the fact is that if they say you can't do it, what they're actually saying is that they can't do it. We can do it all the time.
Yeah.
The future does change. And so just like the weatherman gives, next week's weather report, and then he gives updates along the way because it changes.
Well, and kind of it's the way I akined it to my wife was almost akin to prophecy. We're given the set of circumstances that we are in right now,
mm-hmm.
extrapolate that out, and something can be remote viewed, and probably remote viewed with incredible accuracy. Now, you change those mitigating circumstances, you change a primary actor in that.
For sure.
You know, yeah, you change any filter through which one of those actors are seeing things or change personally. You have now literally, yes, changed the future.
Yeah. Let's say I view myself on a trip or going downtown this evening. And I find that I'm going to be in a car wreck. Okay.
Mm.
I stay home.
Or at the least, you're a lot more alert.
Yeah. Well, no. Yeah. pay attention. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and you know, once again, yeah, you gotta learn when the universe is hitting you with a 2x4, Lynn. Quite literally. And the idea that we can remote view the future. But once again, mm-hmm. that future is fully malleable. It's malleable by the circumstances, by the people, all kinds of things. So once again, much like a prophet says, hey, man, mm-hmm. I've got a message for you. If you don't stop doing this, this is going to happen. And chances are, if you keep doing that, it'll probably happen. You know, prophecy fulfilled. The thing is, like there's an option out, and there's a way to change that future.
Yeah. It's like the Ten Commandments, you know. I've always called them the Ten Advices.
Mm. Yeah.
Don't kill people, you know, they're going to kill you right back if you don't do it.
Well, you know, and it's one of those, even looking at that, Lynn, in the light of, hey, that was a nomadic people. If you are traveling in caravan with another 1,000 or so people, those are some pretty upstanding rules to follow, you know.
Well, they're rules to follow, but they're good advice. I mean, it's like,
that's it.
You know, it always gets me that, this is sort of talking religion here.
That's all right.
But mother tells the kid, don't touch the hot stove. It'll burn you. Don't touch, you know, and keeps saying that. The kid touches the hot stove. It burns him.
Yep.
And then they say, mommy, why did you hurt me? And we as religious people.
Yeah.
Don't do this. Don't do this. Is you going to get hurt? It's, you know, it's advice. Don't do this. Don't do this. We do it. And then we suffer and we say, oh, an angry God was punishing me. No. Yeah.
Well, and let's discuss
the hot stove.
Exactly. And hey, my son had that situation quite literally before we moved into this house. Had that situation. He'd be in the kitchen. He'd be helping and he'd go to reach. Don't touch that. Don't touch the pan. Like, you can crack the egg, you can put it in the bowl, you can pour it in there, but don't touch it. Don't shift the pan like Dad does, bud.
Yeah.
And he went to do it one day, and it was hot. And I was like, well, what'd you learn?
Yeah.
He's never done it again. It's never happened. It took that one time. Like you're saying, that frequently, though, can lead to blocks, can lead to not wanting to explore one's gifts and talents that you may have reticent inside you, Lynn, and that, like you're saying, we all have inside of us and can tap into with remote viewing. And yes, I have definitely, within religious circles at conferences, things like that, heard the word demonic thrown around.
Yeah.
When it comes to remote viewing and people, you know, saying that it is demonic in nature, things like that.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, that's just that's fear. We live in fear these days.
Yeah.
We recording again?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, OK. Yeah. We live in fear these days. And it's the nature of our society. I mean, we're afraid of everything. We can't let our kids even play in our front yard during the daytime and all that, you know?
Yeah.
So we're being taught to be afraid of everything. And the whole thing of, you know, the thing is, and my mother taught me this, you know, I've had these abilities since I was very young, the psychic and the PK abilities. And her attitude was, God gave you that for some reason, so use it for good.
Yeah.
And don't use it for bad. It's just like anything else. And she said, if God gave it to you, there's a reason why he gave it to you. So use it for good. And you know, we had people in the church say, oh, that's of the devil and all that. And her attitude was, and my attitude now is, if God gives you a gift like that and you don't use it, that's the sin.
Exactly. Exactly. You know? I've fallen the precise same camp, Lynn. Because, hey, you know, like, God gave me hands and I can use a hammer. I could build a house, right, or I could go tear one down. You know,
Or you could use it to club somebody, you know.
And, absolutely.
And it's not, well, like they say about guns, you know.
Yeah.
The gun isn't bad. It's the person who uses it, how you use it. Yeah.
Well, and that's precisely it. And I think that is one of the most interesting thing in the world, once again, with the Stargate program, was that there was never any harm, ill will, or ill intent tasked inside the program. No. It wasn't used as a psychic assassin program or something like that. Or a psychic sabotage program. You know, it could have been used 101 different ways to ill repute, ill use.
Oh, yeah.
It was only used as an intelligentsia method.
That's right, yeah. And, you know, because of much of the social programming and the religious program and everything, I had just tried never to use the PK or the psychic ability or anything like that I had. And when General Stubblebine put me into the unit, Skip Atwater, who was the operations officer at the time, took me over to the operations building and into the foyer there, the front room, and he had me sit down and he said, okay, I want you to look around this room and all around this room. And I looked all around the room and he said, okay, I want you to know something. In this room, it's okay to be psychic. And it was like a weight was lifted off of my shoulders that had been there for this years. And over the time of using this and helping bring soldiers home and helping, you know, save the government millions and millions of dollars, it dawned on me, it's okay to be psychic.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah, precisely. And you know, some of the uses that they put y'all to, some of the tasks that y'all were given, I mean, finding hostages.
Oh, yeah.
All kinds of things. Let's get into what was your most memorable military case, Lynn, that sticks with you the most out of everything?
That's really hard. I think one of the most exciting was when they needed some scientific information about a particle beam weapon that they couldn't get because no instrument can step into the beam and survive, you know. And so somebody had the genius idea of having a remote viewer step into the beam mentally. And it was one of the most amazing and most beautiful things I've ever seen in my life. Totally indescribably beautiful.
But
probably, I think, the most important one was when I found a weapon that was planned to destroy the Hajj at the Feast of Ramadan, and it was a stolen American missile, and it would have started a war that would have caused the entire Arab world against the free world, and against the U.S. And at that time, we could not have won that war. And if it hadn't been for that one session, I honestly believe that right now we would have only one choice: be Muslim or be dead.
Wow.
And so I think that was my most important, the one that was most meaningful for me. They had me do a personality profile. And of course, it was always some person, you know, some official in some foreign country or something like that. And they gave me this, the sealed envelope. The monitor had a sealed envelope, and he said, "This is a personality profile, which is where you mentally stand off and look at a person and develop a profile for him. You don't get into their mind or anything like that." And I started off and I said, "This is a good guy. You know, we don't need to view this guy. This is a good guy." And they said, "Well," and the monitor said, "Well, it's a task. Go ahead and do it." By the time the session was over, I felt like I was just glowing. I'd never met anybody that was such a perfect person. I mean, honesty, the sincerity, the purity, just the love for mankind and everything else. And my summary for that was, whatever evil you think this guy did, he didn't do it.
Mm. Yeah.
And the monitor opened the envelope, and the director had just written, it was wound up being a practice session. The director had just handwritten on a piece of paper, "Target is Jesus."
Oh, wow.
And
wow.
In that aspect, of course, I would never say I met Jesus personally, you know, but in that aspect, I just had that contact. And I tell you, there's no church or Sunday school that can teach you that.
Yeah.
It changed my life. That session changed my life.
That's beautiful.
It really did. Yeah.
Now, let's get into a session real quick, okay, Lynn, and what that is about, because I think a lot of people might have misconceptions about, at least about what a controlled remote viewing session is. I know that there are same as colors and variations in the rainbow, there are literally as many types and variations of remote viewing out there. And and really, I guess it's probably one of the only communities that I am involved with where nobody doubts the woo. There's not a single person there that has a problem with the woo, nothing like that. But boy, howdy, when you start dipping toes into different forms and you start confusing them, man, when you can, when you ripple the waters of the remote viewing community rapidly.
CRV, though, we have a definite problem with the woo. We avoid it at all costs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's get into a typical remote viewing session, because once again, a remote viewing session with controlled remote viewing requires monitor and viewer. So let's get into that relationship.
An advanced stage, you can do it without a monitor, but that's advanced stage.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay. You know how a martial artist trains, you know, wax on, wipe off, wax on, wipe off, so that there is a physical response to a roundhouse swing, okay? So that it happens unconsciously if somebody takes a swing at you, okay? And in the remote viewing, we start off by saying water. And you have a pen and paper, and you will draw probably a wavy line, okay?
Okay.
And then we say land, and you draw either a mountain or just a flat line or something. We say space and all that. And we have Ingo developed 7 words that were aspects of any target. There's land, space, water, you know, energy, things like that. Hmm. And you practice these with the monitor sitting there saying land, water, space. The monitor gets more bored than you do. And and you're making these lines on the paper. Pretty soon what the monitor is looking for is that you will start making the line before he calls out the word. Hmm. That's when he knows that your subconscious is now making the line rather than you listening consciously to it. And excuse me, and this is quite a long ways along the line. This isn't in one session. This may take weeks or months before that happens.
Sure.
But then you have developed a physical response. And so then he says, okay, I have a target in this envelope. Tell me what's on it. And your hand is on the, your pen is on the paper, and your pen goes wavy line angle. Okay. And he says, what's the target? You look down and you say, well, I don't know, but I know that a wavy line means water and an angle like this means something man-made. So I'm going to say the target's water and man-made. He opens the envelope and here's a ship sitting on the ocean. Mm. And so your subconscious has given you the major aspects of it. Once you get good at that, then he goes to the next step and he'll do the same with the target. And let's say you say water, land, man-made. And he'll say, okay, good. Now go on down the page and see what descriptors you can get of the land. And so you go down and you say, well, I don't know, it's brown, it's rough, it's, you know, gravelly and all this. And then when you finish that, you say, well, tell me about the water. Describe it. Mm. And you describe, oh, it tastes salty, you know. Oh, tell me about the man-made. Oh, it's tall. It has a light on top and the light's spinning around. Oh, good. Okay. And he takes it out. You've got a lighthouse on the right of the ocean, you know? And so it progresses this way. And once it gets up into the much higher stages, you're getting finer and finer and finer details about it. And that first set of little scribbles where it tells you there's land, water, man-made, that organizes your whole session because you don't have to do the entire target. You don't have to be psychic about the entire target. Just tell me about the water. How does it taste? How does it feel? Mentally stick your finger in it. What's the temperature? Oh, it's cold, you know. And so he asks for, the monitor will ask for physical responses. How does it smell? What does it look like? What color is it? Things like that. Does it make a sound? Tell me about the sound. Mm. And in doing all of this, you wind up describing the target. Now, one of the rules of CRV, if you sit there and you name the target, it makes you set that aside. Because the minute you use a noun, you lock yourself into something and you start your imagination going, and no, don't tell me what it is. Just describe it. And at the end of the session, you've given all these descriptors. Then you hand it to an analyst who knows what the target is, and you've given details about the target that the analyst can't get anywhere else. Mm. And there's no woo. absolutely no woo-woo. Yeah. And anybody who tries to make woo-woo of it, you know, you stop the session. You say, we don't do that here.
And once again, the I've got targets up, things like that from your website. The most remarkable thing about this to me is the statistical evidence behind it. It is not fake. There are numerous remote viewing consultation companies out there, things like that, that are being used to consult on everything from how to build a better city. That was one of the people that was at the conference this last year. I should follow up with her. She was awesome. I had lunch with her a couple times. Pretty incredible, you know, trying to basically remote view different ways to help construct cities better, to help get them to a future of net zero when it comes to energy and that kind of
Absolutely,
stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. I use it for my artwork.
And you know, what
you,
way?
I think
what
you've way seen some you of my art. For,
I have. I almost, yeah. I was two numbers away from winning that piece of art this last year, Lynn. Two numbers. But how do you use your remote viewing in art, Lynn?
I get a blank canvas. Okay. And writers also do this. Mm. You know how you get writer's block? No, you just remote view what the story's going to be when you finish it. Oh, that's what it is? Okay, well, I'll write that down. And it's sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so when I do a piece of artwork, I'll say, picture someplace somewhere. Okay. And now view it. Oh, now describe it in paint.
Yeah.
Don't describe it on paper. Describe it in paint. You know. And it turns out you've seen the artwork I do. It's I know a lot of it. People say you didn't do that. That's a photograph.
Mm.
You know.
Yeah.
And.
Well, and once again, kind of that idea of being able to see it in your mind's eye.
And
different people have that quality in different ways. You know, some people, it may be much more of a tactile feel instead of a location feel that they get.
Yeah.
Some people, like you were saying, are much more tactile and sensory remote viewers where
that's right.
They smell things, they taste things, that kind of, it's a very synesthetic in that way.
Very much so. And in fact, we have found from the very beginning that, each remote viewer will be strong in what they're naturally strong at.
Mm.
And so, we keep data and we keep tons and tons of data and we find out, hey, when this remote viewer views something, they always get the color right, but the other stuff they maybe don't. And so when we task remote viewers, we look in the database, what are you good at? That's the part of the target that we task them with. And as a result, we may have 10 remote viewers who have an overall average of, say, 70%. And yet, when you task them for what they're good at, that part of the target they're good at, at 90%, you put all 10 of the results together and you wind up 90% accurate on the target.
Wow. Now for those that are listening right now and not able to see the screen, I've actively got target details up. I've been going through information on Lynn's site and showing target layouts for the last like 10 years almost. When he's saying that he has tons of data, the man has tons of data. But up on screen right now is a typical task, target tasking. And here is how it lays out. Task. The target is an object. Basic. Describe the physical aspects of the object.
Yeah, that's your, if you're at the basic level.
Okay, we're dealing with a sphere, you know, or a cube, or a polyhedron, something like that. Intermediate, also give details about its purpose, what it does, how it does it, etc. For an advanced student, the task would be not only those things, but to give scalar info, such as measurements, sizes, and also find it on the dowsing map. And in each one of these, you have a link to an overhead map. So this one is obviously, I'm going to take a blind guess here and say that this one is in Russia.
You think?
because the map's in Russian. Just poking in the dark.
But on a lot of those maps, though, I don't have any labeling.
It's harder. And even proves more to the fact of when you can get it right and you can't read the map, there's something special going on there. But that's just it. These things get into great detail. How detailed can a viewer get, Lynn? How detailed can you get? How detailed have you got?
Do you still have that task hanging up?
Yes, I do.
Click on the feedback if you would.
Okay.
Okay. An advanced viewer, a viewer would give you not only drawings of the structure, but the curves, the crossbars, everything else. And would also give you the purpose of it.
A
really advanced viewer could give you the frequency that it's broadcasting or receiving. The angles of it could give you the history of it, the construction of it, the present and past uses of it, all of these things.
Wow.
And down at the bottom of each one of these feedbacks, there are links to other feed, and there's a video of it there. And there's the feedback for the dowsing map. And further down, there are, in the blue there, there are links to further information in case you got information that's not in the feedback.
Wow. Wow. Incredible. Incredible. And I mean, this is a deep star, deep stellar observatory in Russia, is what I gathered anyway, just from my rapid speed reading of the page. To know that kind of data can come out of that. And I mean, the precision of that view right there, the sketching of it. And quite obviously from an overhead view, you know, phenomenal, that somebody was given just a scant amount of data. What would the advanced tasker or the advanced viewer have been given?
Yeah, no data at all on all of those targets. What we give is the date that it was posted. That's your coordinates. You write down the date it was posted and say,
that's it.
What's the target? Yeah. And many times, you know, in the actual tasking, like this was 2016. It was January the 13th, 2016. 1601 13. And that's all you give the viewer. And that way, there's no pollution whatever.
Interesting.
Because that date has nothing to do with the target. And somehow the subconscious knows exactly where to go, exactly, you know.
Well, because somebody has gone and made this page for training on the website, everything else, yeah. And it is released that day on 11/6/13.
Yeah.
Okay. However, so the
today,
go ahead.
Today I give you that date.
Yeah.
Well, you have no idea what day it, you know, you only know the day it was released. And yeah. So you just start your work and you say, what's at the target? You write the coordinates down and your hand goes, oh, man-made land, space. Oh, describe the land. Describe the man-made. Oh, describe the space. Oh, it's looking into space. It's listening from space. Okay.
And once again, the detail of things given or given back as feedback is phenomenal, Lynn. Phenomenal. Yeah. To know that all somebody was given was that date coordinate code at the beginning.
And no other information.
Wow. And once again, what boggles my mind, the library behind me is one shelf of about eight in my house, Lynn, of paranormal stuff, things like that. I mean, one of them is a locked cabinet full of, all kinds of actual occult books, things like that. None of those compare to this. It is absolutely right, phenomenal when you start digging into remote viewing and what is possible. I mean, quite literally, down to words on a page.
Yeah, the first time they gave me a real target, they had this envelope. He said, the first time they sent one of the other people out from the unit and gave them a location around the base there, outside the base that they should go to. And they said, they gave them about 15 minutes to get there. And they said, okay, describe where they are. And I said, I don't know where they are. They said, you don't need to, just describe what you get, So I said, okay, they're driving along, they're looking along, they're lost and all that. And they said, okay, well, end the session. And when they get back, we'll find out, And there were two of them in the car, and they came back and they said, we never could find the place. We kept driving and looking. We never could find it.
Wow.
And the task that they gave me was describe the location where they are. And the monitor had full faith that they had found the location and they were standing there.
Mm.
What I found was people driving in a car looking around and looking like they were lost.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that to me, that first session that I did like that said, hey, maybe I can do this.
Yeah. Yeah. And, with that in mind, Lynn, since our last meeting, quite literally, since I saw you at the IRVA convention, since before I left the IRVA convention, because I had a dream about things while I was there that was pretty revelatory to me. I hold a lot of stock in my dreams. I had my wife put an object in a box.
Mm-hmm.
That box is still on the shelf. It's only allowed to come off the shelf when I start getting things right. Be it texture, shape, color, use, what have you. Every once in a while, I will randomly come up and go, what about this in the box? And she'll be like, no, no.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say I'm discouraged. Not yet.
No.
But I could see how somebody could get rapidly discouraged, Lynn, because you're not going to, I mean, you're statistically, even you with somebody with the PK ability you have, statistically, you can't be 100%, you know?
No, not on average, no.
Yeah.
Huh? No.
Yeah. So how does one, A, get to a ranking percentile to begin with? Pardon me, because I know I'm nowhere near a ranking percentile on what the hell's in that box, my man.
There are three sections.
And I could see how how a student could get very discouraged very rapidly with this.
Oh yeah, I kept a stack of requests for transfer in my drawer, and I'd get discouraged, and I'd hand them in, you know, and all that, and the director wad them up, throw them in the trash. But there are three steps in acquiring really good accuracy and all that in controlled remote viewing. Step one is practice. Step two is practice. Step three is practice. Practice, right? practice. Yeah. And like Gandhi said, you know, the successful person has failed more often than the failure has ever tried.
Yeah.
And, you know, and oh yeah, but one of the things of remote viewing is you'll do sessions and just knock it out of the ballpark, man. You just fantastic score and everything else. And then you'll have another session and it's a real loser.
Just trash. And,
oh man, you sit around, I'm no good. I'm dog meat. I'm pig slot. I can't do this, you know.
Well, once again, I've been through no controlled remote viewing. I've been through no formal training.
Yeah.
I have gone to sleep with intent of that box. Yeah. I have done every trick that I know of. Yeah. And I'm not going to lie, so far I am at zero percentile.
Really. Yeah.
But I'm still working on it and I'm willing to work on it more. And I think that of anything, when it comes to paranormal, and I would call this classically paranormal, not necessarily in the sense of, you know, ghosts, cryptids, that kind of thing, but definitely in the sense of it is scientifically anomalous.
I don't think so. At this point, after all I've learned about controlled remote viewing, I classify it as normal. I classify not being psychic as
the paranormal.
The paranormal.
Yeah.
It's not normal to not be psychic. I mean, we all have intuition.
Yeah.
And the whole secret is, hey, you know, like I said earlier, you get a feeling, hey, pay attention.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Your subconscious is telling you something. Just listen. That's all you have to do.
Many, many years ago, I taught religion to junior high school students, things like that.
Yeah.
Confirmation and the like. And the analogy I used to give them was the kite string. Eventually, you may not be aware of it yet. It may not have happened to you in your life. You may not have been aware of it when it did happen. But I'm here to tell you, pay attention.
Yeah.
Because there will be a room that you walk in. There will be a group of people that you walk up to. There will be something in your life where you walk up and you feel the kite string pull at the back of your belly button.
Yeah,
pay attention to that.
Yeah.
That's the universe telling you to wake up. The situation may be good. It may be bad, but you need to be paying attention.
Yeah.
That I have held to that my entire life, Lynn. Because there is that, and I've had more than one moment where it's like, you know, I don't think I need to be here right now.
Right.
I'm gonna head on out. And then I hear horrible things that happened. You know?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And you do have to learn to, once again, eventually you'll learn after getting bludgeoned by the universe so many times that when the tug happens, listen. And how tied to, because that was part of the conversation I was having with my wife earlier when I was talking about manifesting things in the future. How tied is remote viewing to that concept and to the idea of, I mean, it's definitely tied to the idea of quantum entanglement and the fact that we are all tied together, that all of this is once again agreed upon illusion.
That is one explanation of it. But you know, overall the whole thing is that, you know, your subconscious talks to you all the time.
Yeah.
And here's the thing about the control remote viewing. You're not learning to be psychic. You're learning to listen to yourself.
Yeah.
And it gives you a physical way of doing that. And, you know, it just gives you a way to converse with your own subconscious mind, and your subconscious knows things. It really does.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, how tied is that to, I guess the concept of the monkey mind that a lot of people cannot get past when it comes to the point of, Zen meditation, really, really deep prayer, you know, is it the fact that the monkey mind hurts or helps when it comes? Because to me, the monkey mind is a lot of subconscious, just
it is
random things that pop in, pop out, things like that. So is that helpful or hurtful when it comes to remote viewing? Or is it more a tuning of the monkey mind?
Oh, it's a tuning of the monkey mind. It's a training of the monkey mind. The thing is, with the controlled remote viewing, we found this, beginning students, they get all this, you know, back and forth. We call it winking about the site. You get all this garbage and stuff. It may be at the site, but it's not in any order. Your mind is just bouncing around.
Yeah.
And as you give structure to this process, your inner child learns to grow up. The whole thing about the monkey mind, listen, your subconscious is smarter than you are. It's faster than you are. But if you've never given it any training, it stays a child. And so one of the side effects of learning to control remote viewing is that you find that your subconscious starts growing up and that it loves the ability to, it loves to have the rights and the responsibility of doing the work. And when your subconscious succeeds, listen, your subconscious gives you the information and you finally get the feedback that, yeah, you brought a kid home. You know, you brought a missing kid home. Listen, your subconscious grows up.
Yeah.
It's no longer a monkey mind. And what you find out is it's your conscious mind that's the monkey mind. Mm. The subconscious, listen, it is vastly more intelligent, faster, and we just don't use it. We don't train it from childhood, and we never give it a chance to grow up. It tells us things and we ignore it. It never grows up.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And, you know, to think of it that way, to think of the idea that, what we are trained to do and focus on is actively the distraction.
That's right.
Is pretty mind-boggling and paradigm-shaking, you know. And when you get down to it, yeah, it really is that essence of what's really important is, oddly enough, much like biologically, what's really important is, oddly enough, the things that we don't focus on. Breathing.
That's right. Yeah.
Walking. You know, once you learn to walk, you never have to really think about walk.
Yeah, your subconscious does it for you.
Yeah, you just think about destination and your body goes.
Yeah, and it's your subconscious. I mean, it's your conscious mind that then is oblivious to it.
Yeah.
And yeah, the conscious mind is the monkey mind. You walk through a room in your house, okay? There are pictures on the wall. You don't see those anymore. Your conscious mind doesn't see them anymore.
Yeah.
You walk through that room and one of those pictures is missing. Your subconscious sees it, draws your attention to it, and you think, oh, I consciously saw that. No, your subconscious saw it and drew your monkey to look at it, you know?
Yeah.
It's your subconscious that is the smart one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we go through whenever we have hypnotherapists on, that's one of the things we talk about regularly is the fact of we autonomically roll through about 70% of our day.
Absolutely.
If you're taking the same route to work, you are likely in a state of hypnosis while you're driving. You know, the number of times that you look up and go, oh, wow, I'm there already. You know, these are regular things. Our subconscious wants to take control. It wants be there. It wants to be the forefront of everything if we would actively let it. It's pretty interesting.
It loves having the right to say something to you and be listened to. And it loves the responsibility of taking care of you, taking care of others, taking care of those you love, taking care of the world. It loves it. You just don't get a chance.
That's beautiful, actually, when you stop and think about that. You know, the fact that that is what we are naturally driven to.
Yeah.
And we are much like the psychic propensity, also willing to block that.
Limb. That's right.
And so willing to put the first layer of mortar down before we even have a brick in hand, to wall that off and keep ourselves and others from it. I will say all the time, I will believe any experiencer until proven otherwise. And that is because of my own outstanding and amazing experiences that I cannot explain.
That's right.
I have met more people in the world of remote viewing over the last year and a half, Lynn, and my jaw has consistently dropped. Because once again, as opposed to the other communities that I roll with and hang out with and go to conferences with, like these people, much like you, have reams of data, fingers thick, that isn't just data on what if or the possibility of.
Yeah.
It is data full on confirming the existence of.
Yeah. And it, like in CRV, somebody will say, oh, I got red and there's red at the target.
And that's also because you have at the same time that you have these fingers thick of stacks of paper, you have thick stacks of paper of non-successful stuff.
Yeah. But in CRV, we will say, but you said the round thing was red. Is the round thing red?
Yeah.
Oh, it's not? Then red was wrong.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And forget the fact that there's red at the target. No, you said the round thing was red. Red is wrong.
Yeah.
And And so, I mean, we don't take excuses.
Yeah, precisely. There's no almost.
No,
it is. And that's why I love saying statistically it is there, like, because that's what people want. Like, well, yeah, there is no body like there would be for a Sasquatch here. Yeah. The only body is the body of evidence that is out there that shows this is beyond a statistical anomaly. And once again, to the point that people like yourself and your company, PSI, have been out there providing solutions privately for people for decades. Like, let's get into real quick before we let you go. Some of the things that you've done with PSI and what you do with your consulting work with this, Lynn.
Oh, right now we're doing only teaching. Many of my students have gotten professional, and so when nowadays I'm writing books, I'm doing videos for training and all that. That's taken all my time. And so when I get some actual work in, I look in the database, find out which of my trained viewers is best at handling that type of work, pass it to them, and it builds their business. But, some of the work that we've done, of course, in the military was, not only military work, but also the government is interested in what our other governments are doing. They want personality profiles on other people, you know, in those governments. One of the big things we did was finding hostages. And another of the big things we did was collecting intelligence on scientific and other types of developments, like weapons developments, new weapons developments of other countries. Just things like this, you know, just the military and political, collecting those types of information.
Yeah.
Now in the civilian world, a lot of that has changed, but we take the same procedures. And, you know, we've taught artists how to get it. One of the students sort of went into business. I don't know if he's still in it or not, finding stolen art.
Wow.
And for insurance companies, because they pay for that. And, yeah, we teach people how to go to a casino and come back with money instead of losing. We teach research people. I know there was a plasma physicist down in El Paso who his experiments kept going really wonky. And he came down and he said, "Can you remote view what's causing this?" Because he couldn't find anything. I remote viewed it. I found the cause of it. He corrected the cause and continued on with his plasma experiments. It cured everything. And so, you know, just things like that, helping people. Helping people, I think you were talking earlier about building cities, how to design a city, how to design your house, you know, for your family, because every family is different and the same house doesn't fit every family. So, you know, if you're building a house and you build it for what you are now, is it going to be what you need in 10 years, 20 years when your kids leave the nest and all this? And we do all kinds of stuff like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But it's helping people.
And it is remarkable to see how it is leveraged to do so. It's great to see. Whenever I was at IRVA this last year, the number of people who are using consulting in this way to help further humanity in so many different directions. It's really a beautiful thing. It's great. And what I think is greater than anything, Lynn, is people like yourself and other remote viewers, and even the science of remote viewing finally getting its actual due. In that way, you know, where people see this as a viable science, not just something off a metaphysical shelf, you know, or a flash in the pan government program that was there and gone.
Well, even still, you know, there is a, like people will call me and they'll say, I saw an article in the paper that there's a missing kid. Can you find the missing kid? And I say, well, what are you going to do with the information? Mm. Oh, well, I just want to know. Well, I'm not going to waste my time with that. Hey, put me in touch with the police that are going to actually go out and do it and find it. You know, don't put me in touch with the family, because any information I give, they're going to go on an emotional roller coaster. No, put me in touch with the police.
Yeah.
And so there still has to be, in some cases, a good official use for it. If I work for a company, you know, somebody in the company says, okay, I want to know such and such. I say, okay, is this for your company or is this for you? And they say, well, it's to help the company. I said, good, put me in touch with the company.
Yeah.
Because they're the one who's going to have a, have people sitting around a table saying, oh, here's this idea, or we're going to follow it or not. And if they're not, then, hey, I've got missing kids to look for, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think out of any questions I've ever asked you, Lynn, I think the only caveat you have ever given is be careful what you get into this for.
Right.
Don't say you want to look for missing kids unless you really, really, really want to look for them, because what stays with you may not be so friendly and so nice.
That's right. Yeah. And somebody will say, oh, somebody stole something of mine. Describe who they are so I can go get it back. And how are you going to get it back?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'll shoot them. Well, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, yeah, you know? exactly. And you know, even with the fact of it may be all well and good to want to help find a missing kid, but the things that you see along the way may not be the most friendly. It may not be something that you want renting the spare space in your head.
There have been missing kids that we have found that if they come back to their family, that they're escaping abuse.
Yeah.
And if we find that in a session, listen, I just divorced myself from the case.
Yeah.
Because no, returning that kid to that family where they're going to get beaten and, you know, and molested and all that. No, I'm not doing that. You know, hey, let the kid run.
Absolutely.
Kid's safer out there. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, with that being said, Lynn, I want to thank you so much for your time. I need to have you on so much more regularly. I always love
good
our
talking
conversations.
To you.
I've been popping your site up, but let everybody know where they can go to take their classes, where they can go to take their first step. I'm getting ready to take my first step into the world of remote viewing, aside from my Phantom box, which is outside on the shelf, that I will, I guarantee, as soon as I know what's in that box, I'm going to send you a picture of it.
Oh, listen, when this first came out, this guy kept challenging me. I've got something in the box, you know.
I almost asked you to name the item sitting in front of my speaker.
Well, I wouldn't name it. I would describe it. But he kept challenging me, prove to me that you can do this, you know. And I got the feeling this guy is crooked. Don't do it, you know. And finally, I just said, I have missing children to look for.
Yeah.
I don't care what's in your damned empty box. He wanted me to tell what was in the box so that he could say, ha, yeah. You can't do it. The box is empty, you know. And anyway,
wow.
Good talking to you.
Hey, you too, man.
I really enjoy this.
Same. CRviewer.com is the website. That's where people can go take classes, take trainings.
Down at the very bottom is links to the course. Mm-hmm. Keep going way on down to the bottom.
Hold on. I'm not on the homepage. I'm on the services page.
Oh, on the homepage, yeah.
Down at the very bottom down there. Yeah.
Future courses and links to the courses. And when you click one of those links, it goes to where it says here.
Mm-hmm.
It goes to a page that has a video on it before you sign up. Tells you what the course is, what it isn't, why you may not want to take it, why you may want to take it, and all this. So that I don't want to give a big sales pitch to people, have them pay money for something they really don't want.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I have bought too many things off the internet that, you know, we're just throw them in the trash. And so, you know, it has information. And then, of course, my link is in there. Down at, I think, the very, very bottom is a link to my email address where people can write and ask me any questions they have.
Absolutely, man. And you have artwork, all kinds of stuff
artwork
on there.
Yeah.
It's absolutely awesome. Lynn, thank you once again for your time. I cannot thank you enough.
Oh, thank you.
I can't wait to start taking classes with you myself.
Good deal.
Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience, and I'll be right back with you, man.
Good.
All right, hold the line. While you are online checking out everything from Lynn Buchanan over at crviewer.com, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can find all of the information. If you would like the Stargate documents, you can go to CuriousRealm.com/knowledge. That is our knowledge vault full of all kinds of declassified government programs, PDFs, all kinds of goodies there. Stop on by and check that out. Like, follow, subscribe, share, everybody. Thank you so much, as always, for tuning in. Thank you for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes these conversations possible. That is what makes for a better world. Remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll see you soon, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the knowledge vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit HCUniversalNetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.